Good morning. Well, the ghouls and vampires were out last night for Halloween, a time to dress up, put on the spooky makeup and watch the scary movies. Remember The Shining? Not that I could ever watch it myself, but here's Oliver Callan's remake.
Sir, I must inform you, the loneliness and isolation can be a problem in itself, you know. It can actually drive a man crazy.
Well, let me assure you, that's not going to happen to me. With respect.
From the twisted mind of Stanley Kubrick, a couple take over an isolated, abandoned hotel for the winter.
We can use the deep fat fryers and everything. Wow, the freezers are huge. Look, croquettes, they're like posh chips.
I don't suppose anyone told you about the tragedy we had here back in the winter of 1970?
I don't know who was responsible for that. I don't have any information about that. It's just between me and you now, Mary Lou.
And you can use the time to write your memoirs.
But you see, the issue is I don't remember anything.
Nothing could prepare the young, clean-cut woman for the horrors that awaited her.
Jerry, is that you? I heard strange voices in the night. Voices that said, you were going to kill our election chances.
I did not interrupt you.
Jerry.
I refute the allegations. I was never involved.
Jerry, you're scaring me.
That woman, she came out of nowhere.
This Halloween, the past is back to haunt them.
We have to get out of this hotel. We've run out of chips.
All work and no play makes Jerry a dull boy. All work and no play makes Jerry a dull boy.
Get ready for The Shining.
Here's Jerry!
From Callan's Kicks last night. Well, there were ugly protests and attacks on the homes of Roma families who'd settled in Waterford City last weekend. The protesters said they were afraid and claimed that people engaging in crime in the city were getting away with it. Local politicians went on air to voice their concern at the protests, which Minister Éan Ariarthán described as cowardly and racist. Valerie Cox was in Waterford and she spoke to some of the protesters. Very few chose to go on record with her, but Billy O'Sullivan, well known for his community work, explained why he got involved in the protests.
People are afraid. All we want to know is why the people that have committed those assaults in this city for the last couple of weeks, why have they not been arrested?
But is this not a bit like taking the law into your own hands?
No, we haven't done anything. There was nobody hit. There was nobody kicked.
There were windows broken.
That one window, there were windows broken here every day of the week. There was no violence done to an individual, right?
So what do you want next, Billy?
We want answers. I asked the guard last night, the reason we're here is, will somebody please tell us why they haven't been arrested? And one guard said to me, I will talk to you in private, Billy. I don't want to be spoken to in private. Now, I went in myself with the guard, and the conditions of that house you wouldn't see in the third world. It was absolutely disgraceful. Why are people left living in those conditions?
I was the fella with a bottle of brandy on the middle of the road.
And what were you doing with a bottle of brandy?
Drinking f***ing thing.
Why?
Because I wanted it. I was thirsty. There's no point in doing it on an empty stomach, is there?
Well, they've moved out of the house now.
But they're coming back and forth the whole time. They're not gone out of there yet.
Now, do you think you'd be fairly typical of the neighbours?
Me? I'm one of the neighbours. I'm here, well, 15 years.
Well, would you be fairly typical in your opinion of them?
Yeah. And all the neighbours around here are good people. We don't need them there.
Roma families had gone into hiding, but Valerie eventually made contact with a group of adults and 10 children, all living in one house.
There was lots of people coming at the back of my house. I had small kids in the house. They broke a window at the back.
You must have been very frightened.
Really, really frightened.
So you've left your home?
I left it this morning because I was really, really scared. My partner, my kids are really small. So I said, for the safety of my children, I have to go away from there.
We are 8 years in Waterford. I am stay here 8 years, but never happened again like that. And we are shocked. I have four brothers here. Every time when we were just crossing there, they're shouting on us, gypsies, killing people and all like that. But we are 8 years. We never had a problem here over to the guards even. Like, they can't go back to the schools. Irish people, they don't like Romanians, but I don't know why.
I've been speaking to some of the people who were involved in the protest, and they say that some members, now not all of you, but some members of the community have been involved in crime.
Okay, if some of the Romanian is involved in the crimes, why they go to all Romanian do problems? Not all Romanian are the same. Not all, if it's one Romanian people does problem, not all of them does.
Even our cousin from Dublin, Irish people, they killed her in Dublin, Rostas Florica. We never do anything to the Irish people.
Rostas Maria was your cousin,
yeah,
and she was killed in Dublin.
In Dublin.
What sort of effect did that have on you and the rest of the family?
It's very difficult for us.
My partner, every time he hears about her name, he feels really sad. Sometimes he cries because he remembers the Irish that we live in their country.
So what do you think of the people who protested outside your homes?
Believe me, they give us shock. We have to hide our children. We think that they're going to break into our house and kill me and kill my children.
You have no problem if there is somebody who's done something they shouldn't,
yes,
if they've done something illegal. You have no problem with them being prosecuted.
Absolutely, we don't have no problems. Why did they catch them and bring them to the jail?
Now, so what's going to happen next? I mean, are you going to stay here? What are you going to do?
I want my children to grow up in Waterford, to go to play school, then to go to normal school. My partner goes to English classes in Waterford. I want to study in Waterford. I'm nearly all my life in Waterford. I'm 21 years and I'm 15 years in this country, so I'm nearly Irish. I want my children to be Irish as well.
And Junior Minister for Justice and Equality, Eoghan Reardon, had this to say.
If people have issues around criminality or criminal behaviour, you know, the guards are there to deal with that situation. I think what's happening here is a particularly cowardly act of picking a soft target. I mean, I know from my own constituency and right across the country, people know certain gangs and certain individuals who are involved in criminal behaviour, but it's a bit cowardly, a bit easy to pick on a vulnerable group such as the Roma community. If people have evidence or problems or want to raise something, do it with the Gardaí. Don't organise what looks like effectively a lynch mob.
Minister Eoghan Reardon on the Today Show. Well, some 40 years ago, Bridget O'Toole and her husband Dermot left these shores for a better life in Australia. They worked hard and made their dream come true, building up a successful jewellery business. But tragedy struck when 27-year-old Gavin Perry, out on parole and off his face on drugs, came into their shop and stabbed Dermot to death following a botched armed robbery. Bridget O'Toole spoke with Jonathan Clinch on Monday's News at 1.
He stabbed him twice. He plunged a 20-centimetre knife fully into him and pierced his liver, his heart and his lung. And then he came at me again and stabbed me several times. And then he ran out and people chased him. And he got into a getaway car and got his girlfriend to help him. And they set the car alight, and just a whole heap of events led to his arrest the next day, and Dermot died of blood loss in front of me. He just stood up for an instant. I thought he was all right, and he just looked at me, and he just, his last words to me were, "Call an ambulance, I've been stabbed." And I turned to run and grab the phone, and I turned around, and he was gone. And yep, so that's basically, yep.
Gavin Perry was sentenced to 27 years in prison last week, and Bridget O'Toole is continuing her campaign against parole practices in Australia. But meanwhile, she lives with the consequences of that crime every day of her life.
I'm absolutely terrified, Jonathan. I no longer go out walking. I've had a 6-foot fence with an electronic gate installed in my house, and I don't even get into my bed at night. I just sleep in a chair. I'm too terrified, and you just always think somebody will break in, and I've lost my capacity to feel safe, you know.
Bridget O'Toole heard on Monday's News at 1 with Jonathan Clinch. On the Today Show, the actor McLean Burke, better known as Damien in Fair City, spoke about his own experience of bullying, which started when he was just 8 years old.
I was bullied. I was, you know, go down to the shop and arrive home with half a heel of bread and kind of not say a whole lot about it. That kind of progressed because you allow it in, you know, you don't talk about it. And then it kind of came to a head when I was in school one day and my best friend in school turned on me and we had, you know, fisticuffs. I couldn't understand why this was happening. But as it turned out, it was a former student had come to him that day and said, "If you don't beat up Mac, I'm going to see you after school. And that's the way it went. I mean, the great thing back then was that when I went home, I was still just Mac, and I could, you know, forget about it for the 24 hours or, you know, the 10 hours between school. And the unfortunate thing these days is that you can't hide from it. It's there, and it's 24/7, you know, with your Twitter and Facebook and everything else.
And the bullying didn't stop even when he changed schools.
I was in school about a week, and I was walking home, and this guy turned up. I think he was in third or fourth year. I know him well now. It's funny, you know, we've often spoken about it, and he's apologised, and he stopped and he said, have you ever seen Nightmare on Elm Street? I said, yeah. I went, yeah. He goes, well, I'm your worst nightmare. And then he proceeded to punch me around the place. But it's funny, though, you do reinvent as a child. You make conscious decisions. And I remember when secondary was kind of looming, I said, OK, what can I do to change this? And it was that I finally realised that I was probably large and big enough to deal with these guys.
Well, the junior minister at Justice and Equality, Eoin Oriarthan, was listening to Mac Burke's interview and tweeted that it brought back some unhappy memories of his own. He was jeered with homophobic taunts for years at both primary and secondary school.
The fact that my name is Eoin Oriarthan, I used to be called Gaydon O'Queerden, and this sort of stuff would be constantly sort of said at you and taunted at you. And I used to have a paper round delivering to Northside people, and I used to absolutely dread it, because whenever I went around with my paper bag, there'd be, you know, a number of people who would follow you, go from door to door. You couldn't wait for the paper round to be finished. I used to put earphones in my ears to try and drown out the taunts that you get, and inevitably the batteries would run out. This is back in the late 80s, early 90s, when everything was done by batteries and Walkman, and you pretend you couldn't hear, but it was a difficult thing to go through, and I think a lot of people went through it. I don't think I was alone. But some of the advice you get sometimes from family or friends is, you know, either to ignore it or to stand up for yourself. And I think I kind of did both. I ignored it, and then the odd time I would lash out, and that would kind of get you into trouble, because when you're tall and seem to be taller than the people who are tormenting you, it doesn't look well when you're involved in an altercation with somebody who's of a smaller stature than you are, you know.
From the Today Show on Tuesday. Well, as children around the country spilled out of schools and onto the streets for midterm break and Halloween, UNICEF published a document spelling out the grim news for many of them. The report looked at how children were faring across 41 of the world's richest countries. Peter Power, UNICEF's Ireland director, was on Tuesday's Morning Ireland.
The first league table is in relation to child poverty, and Ireland comes in, unfortunately, of 37th out of 41 countries.
And we slipped down by how much?
By 15 places since the last report. But it's not surprising, because the financial crisis, the economic crisis, the banking crash happened here all at one time. And while other countries came late to the recession and are still consolidating and adjusting their economies, Ireland is now moving out of that. So we fell farthest, or one of the farthest, and we fell one of the fastest. So children's situation in Ireland over the last 4 or 5 years has not been good, but it is coming from relatively good progress in the previous decade.
Okay. Can you translate for us what those words mean? Can you say child poverty rose to 28%? We're talking about 130,000 children. What does child poverty mean for those children?
In technical terms, it means that people whose family's income is 50 or 60% less than the median income, in other words, the average wage. And that means they just do not have enough money to provide for the basics, for food, education, clothing. And it doesn't come as any surprise, of course, Cathal, that, you know, children in Ireland are suffering because we've had a very serious recession. But what we are seeing now that we're moving into recovery phase, we cannot forget the fact that children fell farthest than anybody else in this recession. And the implications for those children will be felt for many, many years to come.
UNICEF's Peter Power with Cathal McCullough. On yesterday's Morning Ireland, reporter Aislinn Kenny investigated the Jobbridge internship scheme, a government initiative which provides work experience placements for job seekers, either school leavers or unemployed workers looking to upskill. And she discovered that 44 companies had been banned from using the scheme. Aislinn spoke with a photographer about his unhappy experience.
Martin Malone, who is a photographer, was hoping to upskill when he took up a Jobbridge internship position with the Munster Express newspaper. However, the paper didn't have a photographer employed on a full-time basis, so Martin was left without a mentor.
And there's no training programme in place. There's no supervision of any kind. either in or out. And quite a lot of the job involved working late in the evenings, early in the mornings, covering assignments, all off-site.
Martin, who says he was working 60-hour weeks, became increasingly frustrated when the paper began selling his photographs.
I was quite happy to go and do the job, take the photographs and supply them to the organisation, knowing that I wasn't being paid for it. But I was would have been gaining an experience and you would have built up a portfolio. But when it came to the fact that this organisation were then selling those images on and offering them for sale, that was probably the final straw for me.
Following an investigation carried out by Jobbridge, the Munster Express was suspended from the programme for 2 months. The paper was also banned from hiring photographers under the scheme. Morning Ireland contacted the paper, which refused to comment on the case. However, the Department of Social Protection noted that the Munster Express had provided valuable work placement and development opportunities to interns in the past.
Aisling Kenny reporting for Morning Ireland yesterday. Leonard Cohen fans had a real treat on Bank Holiday Monday when novelist John McKenna celebrated the life and lyrics of the legend that is Cohen. John went to his first Leonard concert in 1972 at the Stadium in Dublin and was lucky enough to meet the great man and interview him when he worked as a producer in this parish, and he's been smitten ever since.
It's not surprising that The Word has been such a huge part of Leonard Cohen's work over the decades. The Word has always been central. The Word of the Poet, which was his first venture onto the public stage, the Word of the Novel, which brought him a new audience, and the Word of his songs, which expanded that audience. And the wonderful thing is that the words are so extraordinarily beautiful and so extraordinarily powerful. Whether it's the way he explores the darkness of love in a song like Take This Longing, or the humour in a song like Closing Time, or the deep history of humanity's inhumanity in a song like If It Be Your Will. Take the last verse in If It Be Your Will as an example of what the man is capable of capturing in a couple of lines. And draw us near and bind us tight, all your children here in their rags of light. In our rags of light, all dressed to kill, and end this night, if it be your will. There's so much in there. The Holocaust and all the other Holocausts that came before and after. Belsen and Auschwitz. But the subtle change that follows is Cohen at his best. In their rags of light becomes in our rags of light. And then there's that phrase, all dressed to kill. The song turns it on its head. No longer all dressed up. They and we are literally dressed for killing.
From this broken hill, all your praises they shall ring. If it be your will to let me sing. If it be your will, if there is a choice, let the rivers fill, let the hills rejoice, let your mercy spill on all these burning hearts in hell. If it be your will to make us well. Bind us tight, all your children here in their rags of light. In our rags of light, all dressed to kill. If it be your will, if it be your will.
From John McKenna's documentary, Singing Somewhere Still, heard on Bank Holiday Monday. With 1916 looming large on the historical calendar, relatives of the men and women who fought in the Easter Rising claim that they've been ignored by the government, and there's concern in many quarters that commemorative plans are not yet clearly formulated on this vexed subject. Professor Mary Daly is an historian and a member of the Expert Advisory Committee to the government, and she spoke with Sean O'Rourke on Wednesday.
What about the exclusion, it would appear, of the relatives?
I think more generally, we don't know whether they're included or excluded because we don't have a programme at the moment. I would share what has been said about the absence of a programme. I mean, we on the advisory committee have been asking for the government to present a programme, but until a programme is put up there for discussion, nobody can see what's happening and there is a vacuum.
If you as a member of the advisory committee don't know what's going on, what chance has the rest of us?
Oh, I mean, bluntly, I don't think it's been kept from us, frankly. I suspect, unless something's been decided very recently, I think that, you know, there's been a lot of dithering going on within government circles over this, and I don't see why this is so. Can I say there has been action in certain quarters that I think should be applauded. It may not be high profile, but there is significant resources going into making the military pension files available in digital form, a military archive in Rathmines, which, you know, will mean that a lot of the records of what happened, not just during 1916, but also during the War of Independence, are going to be readily accessible. A work on Kilmainham Courthouse, and there is the plan around the GPO. There's going to be a kind of interpretive centre. That's all in train, and that is all quite good. But as for what is going to happen during the period of Easter, the spring of 2016, I don't know anything, and I don't know that anybody does.
Professor Mary Daly. Well, the wind was up on Bank Holiday Monday, but so too was the temperature. So spectators and runners alike got a lovely day for the 35th Dublin Marathon. 15,000 runners, heroes everyone, laced up, psyched up, and cheered on by the thousands of water-bearing well-wishers crossed the finishing line. But it was pride and heartache for 39-year-old Maria McCambridge, who was pipped at the post by Kenya's Esther Makaraya, who took first prize in the women's marathon. Maria was an agonising 4 short seconds behind her.
Everything was super. I just felt brilliant for so long. Just the wind took its toll. I think I came here to win. That was my goal, to win today, and I thought I could. And probably left it a bit late, but I gave it everything and just came up short.
Anybody who saw you cross the line completely spent and exhausted would know you gave it your absolute all. What was your own feeling, though, coming up short, but also knowing you'd run your best ever marathon?
I'm gutted, but it's a happy gutted, because I know that I did run well and I did get everything out of me there.
I have to ask you also, your career is quite a long one at this stage.
Yeah.
And you are running your very best at 39. What's the secret?
I've changed a lot. My whole training system, my whole philosophy. The 3 crucial days that I train hard are really long and hard, but the rest is really about recovery, and it's just really, really enjoyable at the moment.
And enjoyment is everything. Like, you're a former World Cross Country team medalist, you're a former Olympian. There is the prospect that if you keep going this way, that you have Rio as an Olympics in your sights. Will you consider doing that?
I definitely do. I've fallen in love with the marathon all over again. Really enjoyed these last 12 weeks. Just came up short.
Maria McCambridge, with still enough energy to talk to Greg Allen, heard on Monday's Drive Time. Happy to finish, sad it's over, was how ultra runner Tony Mangan said he would feel when his last marathon was run on Monday. Tony spent the last 4 years running in 5 different continents, clocking up over 30,000 miles. But why, Tony? Why?
Why did I do it? Well, to be honest with you, I travelled a lot around the world on a bicycle when I was much younger and fitter. So I always figured the best way to see the world was on foot. You see a country gradually unfolding. The interaction with people is extraordinary. I've stayed in many, many homes, been invited into homes and had wonderful experiences with people in places like going over the mountains in Peru, Indonesia, India, Iran and Turkey and so many other exotic locations. It's just a wonderful way to travel around the world. Most of the way I've run with just a 2 kilo backpack. It's been tough going over the Andes. That was in the winter, but all in all, I've been lucky with the weather.
You've run in 41 countries,
yeah,
and 5 continents in 4 years. One of the obvious questions that strikes me is, how could you afford all this?
Well, Well, I do have some sponsors, but I also had a redundancy check and some savings of my own, which are almost depleted now. But to be honest with you, this has not been a five-star Hilton job. This has been backpacking, running on a budget of 2, 3, 4, 5 euro a day.
You are 57 years of age. You're obviously in great condition. How long are you going to keep going, or do you see the end of the road?
I'm going to finish at the finish line of the Dublin Marathon today, 3 o'clock, a six-hour marathon I'm planning. And the joke is, the medical advice is, Tony, don't you realise you've been running more than 43 kilometres a day, 27 miles? Don't you realise it would be a shock to the system? You really got to ease down 10, 15, 20 kilometres a day for a few months. But no, I'm not going to be taking that advice. I'm going to halt right in the finish line, 50,000 kilometres, not a metre more.
Tony Mangan, marathon man extraordinaire, with Cathal McCullough on Monday's Morning Ireland. Katie O'Halloran from Connemara was born with femur fibula oma syndrome, which left her without arms and a deformed right leg. Doctors at the time believed she would never be able to walk, but her parents never gave up, and neither did she. Katie, who's now 23, is just back from Boston, where she's been fitted with two bionic arms and a new prosthetic leg. And she spoke with Richard Crowley yesterday on the News at One.
And then the next step, obviously, was to obtain these prosthetic arms to give you some further independence. You needed money for that. How much did you need to raise?
Yeah, we needed to raise 300,000 euros. So we all got together at home and we decided we'd go to get these prosthetic arms after I seen them on the internet. We applied for money from the HSE and they gave us money to put towards the cost of the arms. But most of the other money came from fundraising events, big or small, or people donating individually.
So you're just back from Boston where the prosthetics were fitted and you were trained and getting used to them, though I would imagine getting used to them takes a bit longer than just a few weeks. Tell us about them and how your life has changed as a result of having got...
Well, it was a long process, 10 weeks. The new technology on the right side of my arm that works from my brain and the nerve patterns in my hand. I had to be tested to see if I was a suitable candidate because no one was sure if I would be, because it's a technology kind of created for people who had a hand and had lost it in the war or due to an accident or something. So the concept is that if you had a hand there, the nerves for lifting your elbow up or opening, closing your hand or twisting your wrist would still be there and this computer would recognize it. So that was the main thing. So I got tested for that and it was a success and it worked really well. And then I decided to go for a kind of simpler version on the left side just so it wouldn't be so confusing. So I kind of had electronic wrist and elbow and hand, but I have a button that I press at the top to switch between the hand, the wrist and the elbow so it won't get so confusing. And then I started rehab once the hands were made and that was intense. There was a lot of work involved and physio beforehand to get stronger because the arms are really heavy. And then when I had the hands, I was just wearing them for half an hour each day. Then now I'm able to wear them for 3 hours, so I'll just increase slowly.
And what, with this new independence that you have, out of all of that, what do you think has brought you the most joy?
Being able to shake a person's hand, that's a really good thing. And being able to open a door.
Fantastic story. Katie O'Halloran with Richard Crowley, heard on yesterday's News at One. Marion Finucan spoke to a woman, Jackie, who told a true story worthy of a John le Carré novel. The Metropolitan Police has just awarded her £425,000 sterling, along with an unreserved apology, because one of their undercover policemen had used her so he could spy on animal rights activists. Bob joined her group, became her partner, and fathered her child. Jackie was 22, he was 34, and to all appearances, a loving father and partner.
And there's a photograph that's quite widely out there of him at the maternity hospital holding our son and looking at him like any other father would look at what I thought was his firstborn child.
Well, you thought that was his firstborn, and life continued on happily for another 2 years.
Yes, we did. So altogether, it was sort of 3.5 years we were together. Yep, he was hands-on dad. He quite impressed my parents in the way that he changed nappies, he took him out with him.
Did he go away for a few days every week?
Well, you know, I've heard that these, what they call deep swimmers, these undercover officers, they only actually get to see their family every few weeks for one day. I mean, that's why they're paid so much, because of that.
As Jackie mentioned, Bob lived with her and their son for 3.5 years.
And tell me, How did it end?
He once come to me. There's been animal rights action of a kind of some incendiary devices going off in the Debenhams, which is a department store in the UK, because they were still selling fur coats. So, and he, as far as I was concerned, was involved in that. And there'd been some arrests. Some people had been arrested over it. And he, the irony is that he was always, to me, paranoid about infiltrators in the movement. He even wrote an article in our newsletter about how to spot an infiltrator. And he came to me one day in 87 and said that people were getting arrested, which I knew they were. Things were getting really hot. It was just a matter of time before Special Branch were going to arrest him. And he needed to get out of the country. He said he knew some anarchists in Spain that would help look after him, and he could hide out there. He sort of said to us, he said he was going to leave, but he would never abandon his son. So he said it was just a matter of time before he'd be in contact with me and I would be able to take our child over to Spain to see him. And that was it. He that night when he left and I saw the back of him, that was the last I saw of him until I heard from him and saw him 24 years later.
In those intervening years, Jackie married again and had a second son, but her husband died suddenly when she was 30. Only 7 years old, her first son had already lost two fathers, and he spent almost all of his teenage years searching for Bob, but to no avail. But on a warm afternoon in June 2012, Jackie picked up a newspaper, only to see the picture of the man who disappeared all those years ago. The story of Bob's double life had broken, and he was now an academic lecturing in St Andrews University.
So I rang St Andrews University the next day and asked to be put through to him. He wasn't there, but the woman that I spoke to, because I was obviously very upset and she could tell that, and I said I was the mother of his child, she said she'd get a message to him and would ring me back. And 10 minutes later, the phone rang, and it wasn't this woman. It was Bob. And he said, "Hi, Jackie, it's Bob." And that is the first I heard of him for 24 years. By now, our son was 26. And we had a phone call, we exchanged email details, and I didn't know about instructing a lawyer or anything like that. And so for a few months after that, my contact was with him and his now second wife, who he doesn't have any children with. I did ask, because one of the first questions I asked was, does my son have any brothers or sisters, thinking they would be younger than my son. And he told me, yep, and it turns out that my son was his third child, and that when I gave birth, he had not only had a wife, but he had a 9-year-old and a 10-year-old son and daughter.
Scriptwriter John Murphy was listening in studio to Jackie's story. He spent 18 years in the London Metropolitan Police covering the time she was speaking about, and he shed some interesting light on her truly extraordinary story.
I've never heard anything like this in my entire association with the organisation, heard anything like it. And there's an awful lot of unanswered questions here, and I have to wonder whether or not they'll ever be answered. The phrase that you
exactly
read there from the Yard saying we want to be as open was immediately followed by the word but.
Exactly, yeah.
And there was a culture when I joined, as we were told, and I'm literally told, that it was a war on crime. And if you look at this whole scenario, this war, you know, spies, and Margaret Thatcher used a term called the enemy within. She wasn't talking about the IRA who tried to blow her up. She was talking about minors.
It was very easy
to convince us as young men that there was a war going on when we were just really a civilian workforce on the streets of a civilian
providing a service
in peacetime. But it justifies, that kind of culture justifies the end to the means. People do things in a war that they don't do in peacetime, and it's easy, it becomes easier and easier to justify things as they go along.
The enemy within, from the Marianne Finucane show last Saturday. On Tuesday, a number of pro-choice activists sought to recreate the famous contraceptive train journey from Dublin to Belfast, undertaken by feminists in the 70s. There were differences, though, as this time they were going to bring back abortion pills instead of condoms. And the arrival of mobile phones meant Sean O'Rourke could speak to socialist TD Ruth Coppinger as she made her way north on the Enterprise Express.
Tell me about this trip. Is it some sort of basically a publicity stunt?
No, it's not. It's an action to highlight the ongoing ban on abortion in Ireland, which endangers women's health and gives women no control over their life, and which criminalises women as well. It's to highlight also that there is safe pills, that these pills are safe and accessible and could have been used
by poor women, by working class women who are prohibited from taking the journey to England, which is very costly and difficult. And it's 2 years following the death of Savis, and it's also months after the torture of a migrant rape victim in this country, both of whom were prevented from having abortions. So what we're doing is we are breaking the law, just as women broke the law in the 1970s to highlight the ban on contraception in the country.
So, well, I suppose the comparison may not be quite precise in the sense that what they brought back from Belfast was represented a safe way to control fertility. Can you be so sure that you're offering a safe way to deal with a crisis pregnancy to people?
Now, in relation to the safety of this, medical abortion is one of the safest procedures in contemporary medical practice. Medical abortion allows women to access without surgery. There are very few complications. Less than 1% of women have any difficulties with, for example, heavy bleeding. It's exactly like a miscarriage. 20% of all pregnancies end in miscarriages, and women don't generally need any help. A medical abortion is actually safer than driving a car or using Viagra in that sense. With less chance or risk of anything bad happening.
Professor Sam Coulter, Master of the Rotunda Maternity Hospital, was listening to Ruth Coppinger and had this to say about taking the pills.
Well, we would always encourage people to seek advice. I mean, Ruth, she's right in some respects that the risks are low, but the problem is that if you've had a previous cesarean section, if you've had a scar on your uterus as a result of operation on fibroids, or if you've been abroad and had a termination of pregnancy which has been complicated by a perforation of the uterus, then they're the group of women who are at risk of uterine perforation or of uterine rupture as a result of taking these tablets. And that's why it's so important that the history is understood. And that's why it's important that the dose that's taken, the time between doses and the route of administration is well policed and well understood. Because if it's not, if it's taken in an uncontrolled manner, the risk of that happening is certainly there. And there have been situations where women have become extremely unwell. And there are cases where women have died as a result of rupture of the uterus in this type of situation. So it's not without its risks. And we would always encourage people to seek advice.
Professor Sam Coulter with Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday. The Ebola crisis has again been in the news this week, and on Wednesday, the Mater Hospital carried out a training exercise to test how their frontline staff might respond to a possible outbreak of the disease. The HSE has been reassuring people that their algorithms and protocols are well in place, but the story relayed from the papers by health correspondent Catherine Shanahan on the Finucan show last Sunday would suggest that the more practice runs we have, the better.
It would be funny if it wasn't such a serious topic.
It's kind of Keystone Cops stuff.
Yeah, there was a 25-year-old girl called Ruth Fitzpatrick who had been in Equatorial Guinea, and on her way back she stopped off in Cameroon in France. She came back on the 10th of October, and then on the 22nd of October she went to her GP, Saoirse Quigley, because she had a temperature, she had flu-like symptoms. She came into the surgery. There was a handful of other patients there. The doctor took her temperature. It was 38 degrees Celsius, so it was high. She told her where she'd been. So the doctor then put on her, according to the reports, put on her hazmat suit. But because each surgery apparently has only been allocated one hazmat, there was none for the patient. So then she put in a call to the ambulance service, and whoever she spoke to initially seemed confused about why they would want the ambulance service to go to her surgery. Eventually, some paramedics were dispatched. In the meantime, when the paramedics arrived, there was other phone calls going on in the background with the HSE to see, well, actually, are Cameroon and Equatorial Guinea on our list of high-risk countries for Ebola? They weren't too sure about that. The paramedics arrived. They started questioning the other patients in the surgery, which included a child, about what their symptoms were. Then a funniest line in it, sorry to laugh, but there was a mask slipped under the doctor's door for her use by the paramedics. And then the girl eventually...
The image of that is unbelievable.
I know. And then the poor girl, there was debate then about whether to take her to Vincent's or the National Isolation Unit in the Mater, which is the unit for anyone with hemorrhagic fever. She was taken to St. Vincent's, but, you know, along the way they decided that Cameroon and Equatorial Guinea weren't on the high-risk list. Maybe we should have sent her home. She arrives to Vincent's and they've cordoned off an area outside the emergency department. The nurses and doctors there are in hazmat. There's a bit of toing and froing going on with that. In the meantime, after I think about an hour and a half after she presented, she was given a hazmat suit by the paramedics.
The hazmat is the one that looks like Guantanamo, basically.
Basically what you're saying on Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
And then it was 8 p.m. at this stage and she'd first presented herself at 5:15 p.m. and she was told she could take off her suit because, no, you weren't in a high-risk country. You probably have flu after all. And at 12 a.m. she discharged herself and went home.
Catherine Shannon Shanahan, health correspondent with The Examiner, heard on Marion Finucane's show last Sunday. The cystic fibrosis campaigner Orla Tinsley is studying in New York these days, her life having been transformed by a new combination drugs trial. And while Orla's healthier than she's ever been, she described how travelling on the subway while having a coughing fit caused alarm among the passengers.
I was on the subway coming home after hanging out with some college friends, and this guy was sitting beside me, and I was coughing as I generally do with my CF, just so I don't really think about it, you know. And he turned around and he said, "Miss, do you have Ebola?" I was like, "Oh no, I certainly don't." And he looked at me and like thought about it for a second and then fled to the other side of the carriage. So that was in September, and I have experienced that a few times. And since Ebola, you know, did arrive in the States, it's something I've seen more frequently. And even in Whole Foods, when I'm going to get my groceries, usually there's, you know, chocolate in the aisle running up to the cash register, and now it's covered in hand sanitizer of every fragrance. So, you know, it's something that you're aware of, and people talk about it, and, you know, but I think it's not as panicked as it was initially, say like a week ago. I think the atmosphere is less hysterical.
Cystic fibrosis campaigner Orla Tinsley in New York. Well, another Dubliner who's broken the mould is Lauren Boyle. She's only 10 years old and has just won a prestigious European Digital Girl Award for developing her own children's website. She spoke with Fran McNulty on Wednesday's Morning Ireland.
Tell us about the website.
Well, Culture Studio are a series of websites made for kids. And there's a lifestyle site, a maker site, and a healthy eating site. And there are useful tips and helpful links, like what to do on a rainy day, how to draw, or even what to have for lunch.
Tell us about Coder Dojo for people who haven't heard of it.
Well, Coder Dojo is like kids come from all around the world, because Coder Dojo is global, and they just come and they code, whether it's any programming language, and they just learn any sort of thing they want.
Now, you and your coding and your work with Coder Dojo, it's brought you into government departments, into some of the biggest companies in the tech sector in Dublin, and you'll be speaking at the Web Summit. Tell us about, as a 10-year-old, going into the likes of Google and LinkedIn and Twitter and giving presentations to people.
Well, I am part of Code for Ireland, so we've had a couple of meetings in places like LinkedIn and Google, and I was asked by Sinead McSweeney to go into Twitter.
And you address staff there?
Yeah.
10-year-old Lauren Boyle with Fran McNulty. Well, where have all the eccentrics gone? Bang Bang, 40 Coats, Tie Me Up, Slept with the Nuns, names of well-known characters from Dublin's good old days. Well, it seems they don't make them like that anymore. But in honour of those who once were, Bobby Ahern has scoured the papers, libraries and oral sources to compile a book of the sometimes funny, sometimes sad people once familiar on Dublin streets, people like the Houdini of the Ha'penny Bridge.
Tie Me Up, again, this would have been the 20s or 30s. And by all accounts, the Ha'penny Bridge was a bit of a carnival back in the olden days. And we had Hector Gray, who's also in the book, of course. He was yelling his sales pitches for all the different products that he sold. The cartwheel man had a cartwheel balanced on his chin, like a seal with a little red ball. And there was the whip man, who used to whip cigarettes out of his wife's mouth. So Dublin's answered the William Tell there. And there was Blondini, the sword swallower. But the real crowd pleaser out of all these guys was Tie Me Up, who'd go along to the bridge, pull off his top, crack his whip on the ground, and then he'd start screaming, "Tie me up, tie me up." And all the men, of course, would go around. And sure enough, they'd tie him up. They'd bind him in chains and put him in a straitjacket, which he would then try to escape from.
Bobby Ahern, heard on the John Murray Show. Well, I hope you'll stay tuned for Richard Curran. He'll be here shortly after the 10 o'clock news with The Business. But I'll leave you now with the song from Phil Coulter, which he sang live on the Today Show. Grimahauga Vassar Golúther, Tasulam Gurwanshiv Saltasaglor, Bay Emer Horgan were Jantha on Chachtan Chahogan, So Wemsha, Gudian Chachtan and Yishin, Gajeshiv Slan.
See the child with the golden hair yet eyes that show the emptiness inside. Do we know? Can we understand just how he feels? Or have we really tried? See him now, as he stands alone and watches children play a children's game. Simple child, he looks almost like the others, yet they know he's not the same. Scorn not his simplicity, but rather try to love him all the more. Scorn not his simplicity, oh no.